Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Do y'all like the Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs are a four-piece Little Rock-based band that has released three full-length studio albums, including their current album, Brand New Reason. The Salty Dogs have played countless shows, sharing the stage with the likes of Junior Brown, Hank Williams Jr., Old Crow Medicine Show, The Gourds, Pete Anderson, Dave Rawlings, Kinky Friedman, and many more. Their music has also been featured on the new Sundance Channel hit, Rectify. Tune in for the Salty Dogs track, Another Day in a Small Town, on an upcoming episode. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Rocco Cicerello, and the featured piece is this painting right over here entitled City Drive, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Rocco at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight is our 7th annual Father's Show, with stories about the many-faceted role of fatherhood. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, L.J. Mickey Jordan shows us how the role of fatherhood reaches beyond just a biological connection. And we'll end the night with Martin Ferguson as he gets to spend an interesting day with his son. But let's start the night with Jewel Duvall, a dilemma, and her father's courage that inspires her in Just for the Record.
We've been running the star drill at basketball practice for 45 minutes, which was 40 minutes longer than normal. By the time I realized something was wrong, I was bending over with my hands on my knees, gasping for air. Sarah was bending over beside me. It was 1977, and the first year in decades, our high school had allowed girls to have a basketball team. "Do you know what's going on?" I asked. "She's ticked off about something," Sarah stated between gasps. "What a witch," I said. Our coach had the personality of a mean dog on good days, but this was ridiculous. Our baby center spoke up and said she was about to pass out, and coach let us stop. "I want you all to sit your butts down and listen." Coach pointed to the line of folding chairs set up on the visitor teed sideline. Coach started pacing back and forth in front of us. "I must inform everyone tonight that perverts have been identified on this team. This will not be tolerated. I will not have lesbians associated with our basketball. You must go directly home and tell your parents there are homos on this team and get permission to remain on the squad. As she spoke, I noticed there were three girls missing from practice that night, and one of them was my best friend. We had never spoken about this topic, but I figured it was her that had gotten caught. It was dark when Sarah and I left the gym because we only practiced after the boys finished their practice right after school. We didn't speak most of the way home. What do you say? As I pulled into her driveway, I spoke first. I've got to find Laura. I'm not going home until I talk with her. Do you want to go with me? I don't think I can tell my parents about this, Sarah said while staring out the window. You probably don't have to, I joked. Coach is just bluffing. I sure as hell wasn't telling my parents either. That wasn't no bluff, Duval. Those girls are going to get in big trouble. What are they going to do? Send them to prison? I hoped that wasn't an option. Are you coming with me or not? I guess. We set out searching all the places I thought Laura might be. We cruised around Sonic on 4th Street, checked out the parking lot at Walmart, and then drove to one of the girls' houses who was also missing that night. We asked her if she knew where Laura was or what was happening. She said she didn't know a thing, but she couldn't look us in the eye. After driving around some more, we went to Laura's house. I didn't think she'd be there, but her VW was in the driveway. I let myself in and yelled a hello to Laura's dad, who always sat on his couch in the den. He yelled back that she was in her bedroom. Laura was sitting on her twin bed with her back up against the wall. She was surrounded by her stuffed animals, and she was holding one of them. I sat down beside her on the bed. Bad stuff went down at practice tonight, Laura. I've been worried about you. She said nothing, but nodded her head like she knew what had happened. Look, I mean, I hate to say it, but I feel like I need to verify your situation. I mean, I don't care. You know I don't care. But, I mean, if you're not that way, we're like going to go with the innocent defense. But if you are that way, then we're going to like go with that civil liberty stuff. Laura spoke in a near whisper. I guess I can't deny it. Great, I said in a too happy voice. That's great, really. I mean, at least we know which direction to go. We asked her if she knew what had happened, but she wouldn't tell us. Sarah and I left quickly after that, and all I remember Sarah saying on the way home was, oh, crap. The next few days on the basketball team were tense. Our goofy principal and assistant principal would stand at the top of the gym, watch our practice, I guess in case our team members spontaneously started kissing and hugging each other right there on the gym floor. The real witch hunt, though, continued behind the scenes. I learned that some women's coach from a small town got caught sending love letters to one of our forwards. The first girl confessed and gave up the names of the other team members who were also afflicted. One of those girls' dad was an FBI agent, so he and the local police started interviewing girls on our team at the police station about what they were doing and who they were doing it with. Word was each terrified girl gave up other girls as homosexuals. Girls were dropping off of the team like wildfire, but strangely, the girls with terrific athletic ability remained on the team. In the end, it was only managers and assistants who were gone from our soon-to-be state championship basketball team. I broke down the night before I was supposed to meet with the principal. I told Dad the whole thing, how I was afraid it was Laura and how she confessed, how Coach was torturing us in practice like we could exercise out homosexuality, and how the girls were being harassed by the principals, the police, and the FBI. I was confused, I said, and don't understand why the girls are acting that way. Why is Laura that way, Dad? Why can't she just be regular? I asked this question expecting my father to talk about how everybody has problems, all people are sinners. In 1977, there were no gay rights or gay marriage debates in Arkansas. Before Laura confessed, I would have said I never knew one. Maybe Liberace, but that was California. My dad thought for a moment, got a soured look on his face and started in, "Now, Jill, I didn't like the sound of that. Everyone needs someone to love, and it is certainly not your place to figure it out and pass judgment on other people's lives. Why are you the way you are?" Dad waited for my reply. I don't know, Dad. I've never really thought about it." "That's right. But when you start to think about what other people are doing, usually it's best to focus on oneself. You focus on Jill, and the rest should work itself out." I felt horrible and ashamed and went quickly to bed. The next day, my father accompanied me to my meeting with the principal and assistant principal. I noticed walking in that Dad's posture was unusually straight. The meeting started when the principal said we were there to discuss if Jill knew anything about the shenanigans going on with the girls' basketball team. Before I could answer, my dad stood up from his chair and towered over the desk and the principals. "Now, hold on there, gentlemen. I'm here to offer you fellas a deal. You're going to stop harassing these girls, and I agree not to go public with the sexual activities of the boys' football and basketball teams. I am not even going to mention the sexual behaviors of multiple members of your teaching staff." Then my dad had a long stare-down contest with the principal and the vice principal. Dad won. He then grabbed my hand and out we went. Strangely, the principals quit interviewing girls after that. In a few weeks, team practice returned to the new normal, and soon our team became the 4A state basketball champion. And for the record, and in homage to my childhood friends, particularly Laura, there were homosexuals on our team. Some of them had excellent vertical jumps. Some of our team members did turn out gay, some straight, but we all remember our championship season. And for the record, and in honor of my father, your living demonstration of acceptance, wisdom, and bravery enriched my teenage years and continue more than 30 years later to influence my life. Thanks, Dad. It was a great start.
Jill Duvall lives in her hometown in Arkansas and writes stories to make sure her memory holds up. She is the author of a mystery ebook set in her hometown named Premeditated Blues. Next, LJ Mickey Jordan's son asks for a favor, and it ripples through several fathers to a boy for the wish of his life in Willie's Dream.
My secretary informed me my son was on line one. Since it is unusual for him to call me at my office, I figured it was important. "Hi, Patrick, what can I do for you?" "Dad, one of my friends here in Memphis is on the board of directors of Dream Factory. This is an organization similar to Make-A-Wish. They work with young people who are either critically or terminally ill, and they arrange for that child to experience his or her fondest desire. There is a 10-year-old youngster here in Memphis who is not expected to live. He idolizes Brett Favre. And Dream Factory would like to arrange for him to meet Brett. I told them you knew Brett and played golf with him in the off season. They asked if you would find out if Brett would meet with Willie. I can't promise anything. It's football season, and I'm sure time is of the essence due to Willie's sickness. It may not be possible. 2 days later, I telephoned Irvin Favre, Brett's father. I explained the situation to him and asked if he would run it by Brett this coming weekend when he was attending the game in Green Bay. The following Tuesday, Irvin called me. "Brett would be happy to do it," he said, "but we must deal with the Packer organization. We should call Ed Martin at the Green Bay Packers office to arrange a meeting." I passed the information on to Dream Factory. Within a month, Patrick called me, all excited. "It's unbelievable what they did for Willie." The Green Bay Packers flew Willie and his parents to Green Bay on Friday before the game and set them up in a luxurious hotel suite. Saturday morning, Willie was taken to Lambeau Field to meet Brett. He was given his own custom-made jersey. Brett played catch with him and let Willie accompany him through the entire practice. He told Willie, "I'll throw a touchdown pass for you tomorrow." That evening, Willie ate dinner with the team. Of course, he sat with Brett. He was introduced and received a standing ovation. Willie and his parents had seats in the Packers' corporate skybox on the 50-yard line. To make it even more special, the Packers won the game, and Brett threw two touchdown passes. After the game, Willie was escorted down to the field. Brett greeted him, took off his jersey he had worn in the game, gave it to Willie, and hugged him. 3 weeks later, my son Patrick called again. "Dad, Willie died last night. Please inform Brett and thank him again." Irvin returned the following Monday from having watched the previous day's game. He said, "I gave Brett the news as you asked. Being a father of two, he took it hard. In fact, he teared up." Later, my son Patrick had occasion to meet the child's mother, who thanked him profusely. "Willie was a sad little boy most of his life," she said. "But for the last 3 weeks of his life, after the trip to meet Brett in Green Bay, he couldn't get the smile off his face."
Mickey Jordan resides with his wife, Becky, in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. He is a member of the Village Writers Club, a graduate of the University of Tennessee, and has written numerous award-winning short stories. In our final story of the night, Martin Ferguson gets to spend a day with his son, and his son talks him into something he'll not soon forget in State Fair.
Every year as the Arkansas heat turns itself down from 104 to only 92 degrees, the State Fair rolls into town with its collection of fried food vendors, prizes valued at least 32 cents each, and an assortment of Arkansas's most interesting citizens. Each year I take my son Teddy down on wristband night where you can ride all of the rides for one low price. I do this not because I'm too cheap to go on full price night, but because if you go on wristband night, you will truly get to see Arkansas's finest up close and personal. As we approached the fair, a large colorful ride hurled people over the top of the fairway in what appeared to be a small Cold War era Russian space capsule attached to a 40-foot long arm, all swirling in a broad circular motion. My son grabbed my arm as we approached the gate and pointed at Soyuz 1 and said, "I want to go on that." I smiled at him, shaking my head. "There's no way we're going to wait in line for that thing. And once we finally get there, you start screaming to be let out." His obvious disappointment was distracted quickly as the ticket taker ushered us through the cattle gates and towards the wristband booth. Like livestock to the slaughterhouse, one fried Snickers at a time. Once inside, we ran through the usual row of carnival games, where I've taught my boy to very politely say to the carnies, who are beckoning us to play their games, "No, thank you. Maybe later," instead of "Dad's too cheap." Once we got through to the other side where the rides actually start, he picked the first ride. It was shaped like a 1950s UFO. The ramp was open, and a few customers were working their way inside. "If you don't want to do the Firewalker, then let's do the UFO," said my son with steely resolve. We walked past the man in charge, showing our wristbands, and made our way into the silver disc. Once inside, we found ourselves with a small group of teenagers, obviously enjoying their time away from their parents. We walked a semicircle to the far side of the disc and found two secluded spots away from the crowd. Just as the ramp was about to close up, a small gray-haired elderly lady appeared at the foot of the ramp, ready to come inside. She looked like a farmer's wife who had made a wrong turn and ended up on the UFO instead of the finals of the jam and jelly contest. She sauntered over, strapped herself into the spot next to us, and didn't say a word to anyone. I looked at the ride operator/DJ, sitting in a rollerball-esque control room in the middle of the ride, also eyeing the lady. Our eyes met, we both shrugged our shoulders, and I silently prayed he had his finger close to the emergency stop button, hoping this ride would not turn into a Logan's Run simulator. The ramp closed, the ride started to spin, and the centrifuge started to pull our bodies up the inner wall. After several revolutions, the ride slowed and then stopped, our feet coming back into touch with the metal deck. I couldn't wait to see what was left of Aunt B after that ride. To my astonishment, I watched her casually unhook herself, walk off the ride, obviously feeling no major after effect. She was unemotional and actually seemed a little disappointed. Outside, just as I'd mentally predicted, awaited her husband, a small elderly man in overalls and a cap. She approached him. I heard him ask if she enjoyed it. She replied very simply, "It was okay." The two walked into the middle of the fair crowd, surely headed for the bungee jump pit. Going to the bathroom at the fair is an interesting proposition. First, you have to find it. Of course, it's located at the far end, conveniently by the livestock barn. No matter how bad the aroma is from the bathroom, it cannot overcome the cattle smell. We walked up and joined a line waiting to get into the 1940s era bathrooms. Two men in their early 20s waited not so patiently in front of us. The discussion was whether they could handle the fair's beast of a ride, the Firewalker. The sandy-headed man in the sleeveless t-shirt exclaimed for all to hear, "The only way I'm going on it is if I have about three more beers in me." His friend, the redhead, smiled and said, "If you drink three more and try to get on that biggin, you're not riding with me." Sandy Hair finally got his turn in the stall and returned out fairly quickly, patting Red Hair on the shoulder. "No toilet paper in the stalls, man, sorry." Red Hair's shoulders dropped like a condemned man heading to the gas chamber, but went into the stall anyway. I shooed Teddy in and out quickly, ready to move on down the midway. Any hope I had of going around the Firewalker that night was quickly dashed as Teddy ran ahead of me towards the monstrosity, pointing and yelling, "The line's not long, the line's not long, we can get on quick." Sure enough, only three people stood in line as everyone else had made their way to hear the country music act currently taking the main stage. "All right," I said, sizing up the pod that would carry us up above the fairgrounds. "Let's do this then, no whining." We jammed ourselves into the small capsule and the highly trained staff prepared us for our journey. They are trained. A small, swarthy man with an accent that I believed coming from Kazakhstan came by and closed the lap bar down on us and slammed the door. "Keep hand and foot inside. Dangerous." We got ready to be launched. I looked over at the arm that was holding onto the side of our pod, the same arm that would be the only thing keeping us from being flung into space, or at least deep southeast Pulaski County, and noticed a note had been written, hand-scrawled in a black magic marker. It was written over a bolt that appeared to be the main fastening system holding the pod to the arm. "Do not remove," it said. I rolled my eyes and felt my son squeeze my hand. I squeezed back very tightly, and he said to me, "This will be fun. I promise I won't be scared." Now to tell myself not to throw up on him, after I'd made such a big deal about him chickening out. Back on the ground safely, I asked my son if he wanted to get a giant bag of popcorn for the road. "Sounds awesome," he replied with a tired but satisfied grin. With popcorn in hand, actually under arm, we made our way to the car and then into the night towards the suburbs as the Firewalker rotated upward and flashed against the low harvest moon.
Martin L. Ferguson resides in Maumelle, Arkansas, with his wife of 15 years and his son of 11 years. He is an avid podcaster, writer, and neighborhood humorist. His work has previously been featured on Tales from the South. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Another day, another dollar that I lose. Another wasted night I spend here sipping these cheap booze. Just another day in the life of a fool. And I'm singing another sad country song. A song about a heartache and a love that's gone wrong. This sad state of men has caused me to start thinking, well, this honky tonk is gonna drive me to drinking. Another song on the jukebox that I choose, and I can't help it if I still in love with you. Just another day in the life of a fool. And I'm singing another sad country song. A song about a heartache and the love that's gone wrong. This sad state of men has caused me to start thinking, and this honky-tonk living is gonna drive